Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 114, Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng.
Elena, someone burned down your house with you inside. Do you know anyone that would do this?
One day your life is settled and you know who you are, or at least you think you do.
This is Mia. She's new to Shaker.
Hi, Mia.
Hi. Do you even know anything about this woman?
I saw her sleeping in her car.
You rented to a homeless person.
You know what felt good? Helping. I've been meaning to hire someone for my house.
You mean to be your maid?
I meant more of a house helper.
Did I do the right thing? Running from the truth?
A good mother makes good choices.
You didn't make good choices. You had good choices.
Have you really looked at yourself? The parts you're afraid to look at.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that's brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. As always, I'm your host, Tom Panarese, and along with me is my lovely co-host, who is hopefully not setting fire to every bedroom in my house as I sit here, the lovely Stella. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Yeah, I wonder where I would start the fire, and then which places would I end the fire. But I can, you know, if I decide to become an arsonist, I can zoom away on my newly purchased motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe you didn't start the fire. Maybe it was always burning since the world's been turning.
Yeah, is that Billy Joel song?
Yes, it's a Billy Joel song.
Yeah.
And everybody just turned off the podcast.
Are they not a fan of Billy Joel?
No, it's I know at least a couple people who are do not like that song. So,
it's
me making a very lame joke too. So.
Oh, okay. It's a very long song, I recall.
It is a very long song, yes. Anyway, we are doing a different kind of fire here. We are doing Little Fires Everywhere. But before we get to that, you do have a motorcycle.
Yeah.
What else have you been doing or been up to?
Yeah, I think just trying to survive. We're on the home stretch of school. Both of us are. And I'm looking forward to my seniors are about to go, which will be a very sad day, the first week of May. Yeah. But my Latin threes are about to begin. One of my boyfriends, Julius Caesar, his commentary on the Gallic Wars. And yeah, so their first foray into authentic Latin. So I am excited about that. Yeah, I did have to say, because obviously many of my students, if not all, are trained already that, you know, they know that Julius Caesar is one of my boyfriends. And so they don't even flinch when that happens. But I did have to step back when I was giving them cultural and political context for Caesar in preparation of this. Is like, even though I say all of this, I just want you to know that I'm not, you know, actually like a sycophant, and he is problematic at times. You know, there is some corruption there. He played the game well, all of that. So just so they know that I will obviously hold people accountable when I see fit. But yeah, it was interesting. And then, you know, talking about Roman, not really politics, but sort of the state of allyship and these, the populares versus the optimates. And I was like, oh, what would that be? And thinking about Donald Trump and that he would be both types and, you know, Bernie Sanders. So I like tried to bring that in. So of course, then someone who wasn't there And I sent the slideshow to her. I said, just so you know, you're going to see Donald Trump's name twice on this. And I'm not trying to make any sort of political statement. I was just trying to give an example. But it's been, yeah, a fun couple days just getting into that. And tomorrow's the big day. So, yeah, that's mainly, cool. I guess, my nice. Life is work, I think, until yeah. it's not.
What's your last day with the seniors?
The 6th of May.
Same for me.
Yeah, and then they have a senior work project. So they'll ours, be around.
Yeah, ours, their last day of classes is the 7th, and then they have like the senior picnic and day and everything lovely. The 8th. But the 6th is the last time I see my group of seniors specifically. It's also the day of the AP exam, so I'm not going to be seeing all of them. But yeah, my student teacher decided to extend her stay for like another week and a half or so to go all the way to May 8th. So,
oh, okay.
She's like, I'm not doing anything because she lives in Richmond.
Oh, oh,
and
wow.
she's going to be working out in Hanover County. Yeah, she has to keep coming in for UVA stuff because she's graduating. So she's like, I might as well just come in and do my and be. And she really likes the kids too. So yeah, that'll be kind of fun.
Hopefully,
yeah. So we will get to our book then. We are looking at Little Fires Everywhere. It's a novel by Celeste Ng, and I'll get into all of the bio stuff in the background. But before we do that, Stella, what's your history with this book?
Yeah, this book was, I mean, pun intended or not pun intended, I think catching fire pretty quickly around the time, you know, that it came out. I mean, yeah. it very much, it was on the, I don't know, the literature zeitgeist, if such a thing exists. Mm-hmm. And I recall getting it out and, well, I think there was definitely a hold wait on it, which was a bit easier to get it out this time, and yeah, devouring it very quickly and really enjoying it. I checked on my Goodreads and apparently I gave it 5 stars the first time I read.
Wow.
Which is pretty big praise for me. I know I don't give 5 stars very often. And then also I enjoyed the adaptation with Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That came on Hulu, I believe. Some things were changed, which certainly we might bring up or not, in terms of like who are these Pearl and Mia type people. But that's, yeah, basically my history. This is my second time reading it, but third time experiencing it as a story.
Okay. I had heard of the novel when it was big. I had I think I'd like bookmarked the series on Hulu, but never watched it. And now that I don't have Hulu anymore, I probably won't, but I had heard of it. So it was on my radar. It was on my interested in reading this list, to be read list. So I was going to check it out at the library, probably. And then last October, I believe, I was at the library book sale, as I go every, you know, twice a year or so. And this was in the, you know, in the piles for $3 for the hardcover. So I went ahead and picked it up. And then, like I said, at the end of last episode, chose this because it was just on my TBR. And I'm like, this looks like it's interesting. And I've been wanting to read this. So there was no like real reason for me choosing the book this time around. It was just like, oh, I've been wanting to read this. Let's do this for the show. Cause it was a pretty big book in its time. And such. So this is my first time reading the novel, and it'll be interesting to hear what you think about it after a reread. You know, does it like still hold up? Because you did give it 5 stars, so mm-hmm. we can. When we get to after the plot synopsis, I ask you, did you like it? I would like you to tell me how you would re-rate the book, regrade the book. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So, but. Let's get into who our author is and how the book came about. I'm going to read Celeste Ng's author bio from her website. Celeste Ng is the author of 3 novels, Everything I Never Told You, Little Fires Everywhere, and Our Missing Hearts. And a quick footnote, I found a copy of Our Missing Hearts a few weeks ago at the same book, Friends of the Library sale, so I have that now too. In my TBR. All right. So her first novel, Everything I Never Told You, in 2014 was a New York Times bestseller, a New York Times notable book of 2014. It was Amazon's #1 best book of 2014 and named a best book of the year by over a dozen publications. Everything I Never Told You, was also the winner of the Massachusetts Book Award, the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature, the ALA's Alex Award. It has been translated into over 30 languages and is being adapted for the screen. Her second novel, Little Fires Everywhere, was published in 2017. It was a number one New York Times bestseller, a number one Indie Next bestseller, and Amazon's Best Fiction Book of 2017. It was named a Best Book of the Year by over 25 publications, the winner of the Ohioana Award and the Goodreads Reader's Choice Award for 2017 in fiction. It has spent over a year on the New York Times bestseller list. Little Fires Everywhere has been published abroad in more than 30 languages and was adapted, as we said, into a limited series on Hulu starring Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. Her third novel, Our Missing Hearts, was published in October 2022 in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. and was an instant New York Times bestseller. Celeste grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Shaker Heights, Ohio. She graduated from Harvard and earned an MFA from the University of Michigan, which is now called the Helen Zell Writers Program at the University of Michigan. Her fiction and essays have appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, and many other publications, and she's a recipient of the Pushcart Prize, a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, and a Guggenheim Fellowship, among other honors. Her inspiration for the book, from the Wikipedia entry about the book, she is from Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is where the book is set. She said that after being away from Shaker Heights for 10 years, she, quote, appreciated more all the ways Shaker Heights is unusual, and she wanted to try to write a story that would explore some of those facets of the community. She chose to include interracial adoption in the novel because it's an issue that touches on race, class, and motherhood simultaneously. And in an interview for the Los Angeles Review of Books, Ng said, "Many adoptions today are transracial, which raises really complicated questions about how we handle and talk about race and racial bias in America." The book itself was a Kirkus Review starred review. It says, with her second novel, Ng further proves she's a sensitive, insightful writer with a striking ability to illuminate life in America. In a review for the San Francisco Chronicle, Alexis Burling described the novel as a finely wrought meditation on the nature of motherhood, the dangers of privilege, and a cautionary tale about how even the tiniest of secrets can rip families apart. And Lionel Shriver, writing for The Guardian, found the book extremely well done, and yet she didn't warm to it. The miniseries, by the way, produced by Witherspoon and Kerry Washington, and was an 8-episode miniseries, and Ng did serve as one of the producers. Our characters cast were played by, we have Elena Richardson, who is the mother of the book, was played by Reese Witherspoon. Kerry Washington played Mia Warren. Joshua Jackson, Pacey from Dawson's Creek, for those of you who think that name's familiar, was Bill Richardson, who was Elena's husband. Rosemary DeWitt was Linda McCullough, who was Elena's childhood friend. Jade Pettyjohn was Lexi Richardson. Lexi Underwood was Pearl Warren. Megan Stott was Izzy Richardson, and Gavin Lewis as Moody Richardson, and Jordan Elsass as Trip Richardson. So the plot synopsis, and I should note that I grabbed this from Spark Notes, because the Wikipedia summary, even though there's a note that it's too long, actually leaves quite a bit out. So I wanted to make sure this was thorough. So it is a long one, but here we go. It is 1997 in Shaker Heights, the planned suburban community where the Richardson family lives. Mrs. Richardson works as a local reporter, and Mr. Richardson is a lawyer. They have 4 children, Lexi, Trip, Moody, and Izzy, and all those kids attend high school. The story begins with the house on fire. Izzy, whom the others suspect of setting it, has disappeared. The story then shifts to 11 months earlier and reveals all of the events that lead up to that fire. Mia Warren, an artist in photography, and her daughter Pearl move into Mrs. Richardson's rental property. The Warrens move often as Mia looks for inspiration for her work. This time, however, Mia promises Pearl they will stay. She gets a part-time job at a Chinese restaurant to help pay the bills. One day, Moody rides his bike over to meet them, and he and Pearl, both 15, become friends. He introduces to his family. Pearl begins to spend a great deal of time with the Richardsons. Moody has feelings for Pearl, but she develops a crush on Trip. To thank Pearl for writing her college application essay, Lexi brings Pearl to a friend's Halloween party. Everyone at the party is drinking. Pearl spots Trip, but then he disappears. Lexi and her boyfriend Brian leave the party to have sex. Pearl, feeling deserted and a little drunk, calls Moody, who picks her up and takes her home. The next Tuesday, Mrs. Richardson stops by her rental property and offers Mia a part-time job cleaning and cooking at her house, and Mia accepts. One morning, as Mia cleans the Richardson's kitchen, she notes that Izzy is home from school. Izzy has been suspended for breaking the music teacher Mrs. Peters' bow and throwing it in her face. Izzy explains that she behaved this way because Mrs. Peters had picked on a shy black student. Mia surprises Izzy by asking her what she is going to do about it. Inspired by Mia's words, several days later, Izzy, Moody, and Pearl stick toothpicks into the door locks at school, jamming them shut. Unable to use the teacher's lounge, Mrs. Peters rushes to the girls' bathroom but has waited too long and urinates on the floor. The shame and gossip of this event follows Mrs. Peters through to the end of her career. Later, Izzy asks Mia if she can be her assistant, and Mia agrees. On a field trip to an art museum, Pearl and Moody see a photograph of Mia holding a baby in her arms. They later show Izzy and Lexi. Mia claims not to know about the photograph or the photographer, Pauline Hawthorne. Izzy asks her mother to find out about both of them. Mrs. Richardson tracks down and phones Anita Reese, the New York art dealer who sold the photograph, but Anita hangs up on her. The Richardsons attend a birthday party at the McCullough's house for the McCullough's baby, a Chinese infant abandoned at a fire station 10 months earlier. They've named her Mirabel, though a note with the baby said her name was Mei Lin. The McCulloughs, who can't conceive their own baby, are in the process of adopting Mirabel. Lexi becomes fascinated with Mirabel and later tells Mia about her. Mia recalls Bibi Chow, a young Chinese woman at the restaurant, left her baby at a fire station because she couldn't care for her. When Mia tells Bibi about Mirabel, Bibi calls the McCulloughs and goes to their home, but they call the police. Mia advises Bibi to go to the media with her story, and it begins to dominate the news. Lawyer Ed Lim offers to represent Bibi, and her Mr. Richardson agrees to help the McCulloughs' lawyers. When Mrs. Richardson realizes that Mia informed Bibi about the baby, she decides to investigate Mia. She learns that Pearl was born in San Francisco. Using this lead, Mrs. Richardson discovers that Mia Warren is actually Mia Wright, one of Pauline Hawthorne's former students in New York. Mia's parents live in Pennsylvania, and she took her younger brother's name, Warren, after he died. Meanwhile, the custody case for Mei Lin / Mirabel remains a controversial topic. Baby is granted visitation rights until the case is settled. Mrs. Richardson feels angry at Mia for stirring up trouble and goes to visit Mia's parents. Meanwhile, Pearl and Tripp begin a secret affair. Lexi discovers she's pregnant with Brian's baby, and she asks Pearl to come with her to the abortion clinic. At the clinic, Lexi gives her name as Pearl Warren because Mrs. Richardson knows the clinic's director. At the same time, Mrs. Richardson learns from the Wrights that Mia was a surrogate mother. The narrative then flashes back to tell Mia's story. In 1980, Mia Wright takes a photography class in New York taught by Pauline Hawthorne, who becomes her mentor. One day in March, a man on the subway introduces himself as Joseph Ryan. He and his wife cannot have a baby, and they offer Mia $10,000 to carry a baby for them. Needing money for school, Mia accepts their offer and becomes pregnant in September. Her brother Warren disagrees with her decision, and they stop speaking. When Warren dies in a car accident, Mia returns home where her parents become dismayed about her decision to be a surrogate. Mia takes Warren's car and drives back to New York. She writes a letter to the Ryans telling them that she lost the baby and leaves for San Francisco, where Pearl is born. Mia returns to New York to see Pauline, who was dying, and Pauline takes photos of Mia holding Pearl. Needing money, Mia sends one of the photos to the art dealer, Anita, in New York to sell and eventually begins a life on the road with Pearl. Mrs. Richardson learns about the Ryans and how they paid Mia's medical bills. Meanwhile, after Lexi's abortion, Pearl brings Lexi home, where Mia comforts and cares for Lexi. At the custody hearing, Mrs. McCullough testifies poorly about the McCullough's ability to raise the baby to know about her Chinese culture. Moody discovers Pearl and Tripp together at her home, and Lexi breaks up with her boyfriend, Brian. Looking for something to use against Bibi, Mrs. McCullough tells Mrs. Richardson that Bibi may have recently had an abortion. Mrs. Richardson manages to peek at the abortion clinic's records and sees the name Pearl Warren. She believes that Pearl got pregnant by Moody. This same day, the judge rules in the McCulloch's favor. After the verdict, Bebe goes to Mia's house and cries. When Izzy becomes concerned for Bebe, Mia tells her that people find a way to start over, just as new things grow on scorched earth. Mrs. Richardson goes home and accuses Moody of making Pearl pregnant. Moody replies that it was Tripp who was having sex with Pearl, not him. Izzy overhears their conversation from her room. The next morning, Mrs. Richardson confronts Mia about the Ryans and tells her to move out. Mia calls Pearl out of class and says they are going away. She tells Pearl the circumstances of her birth and explains that Mrs. Richardson has found out. As they pack, Izzy appears at the door. Mia reminds her of what she said about scorching everything to the ground and starting over. Leaving some photographs for the Richardsons, Mia and Pearl go. Back at home, Izzy argues with Moody because he told the mother about Trip and Pearl, and she confronts Lexi about the abortion. When she goes back to Mia and Pearl, she sees they have gone. The next morning, Izzy pours gasoline on her siblings' beds, drops a match on Lexi's, and runs away to find Mia and Pearl. The house burned, the Richardsons move into their rental property and find the photographs Mia left, each photo reflecting one of the family members. They later hear that Bebe took her baby from the McCulloch's home and boarded a flight to China. In their car, Pearl and Mia wish Izzy was with them. At the same time, Izzy has gotten on a bus to Pittsburgh to see if the Wrights can lead her to Mia. Mrs. Richardson vows to search for Izzy and make amends. And that is the plot of Little Fires Everywhere. Stella, what did you think this time around?
Well, first, I'd like to know if you're Team Dawson or Team Pacey.
I watched very, very little of that show. But I was not a fan of Dawson, the character.
Oh, sure.
So I would probably have gone for Pacey had I watched more than a handful of episodes.
Just wanted to check since you mentioned him. Yeah. Yes, I still enjoyed it. This was definitely a speed read for me, but still enjoyable. I think the second time around, maybe I would give it 4 stars instead of 5. But I think it still carries with it emotional weight and the themes I very much appreciate, and sort of the intersectionality of the stories and how people are very much relating to each other, even when they feel like they're not relating with each other. I feel like it's crafted really well.
Yeah, I agree. I really did like this. It took a little while for it to get going, but that seems like most books for me lately. And then I think I got like maybe 40 pages in, and I was like in for the long haul. And I thought that Ng did a really good job of juggling a very large cast of characters, because it's like 8 or 9 people, I think. The Richardsons are 6. Then you have Mia and Pearl, that's 8. Then you have Bebe and Linda. So it's like 10 people who are like really important to the plot of this novel. And that's not the easiest thing to pull off, right? Mm-hmm. Not everybody can write like the freaking X-Men and stuff like that. So I thought she did a pretty deft job at getting through it. And then the plot was really, really well done. You can nitpick bits and pieces of it, and that's what we're going to do on the show, because that's what we do. But overall, I really, really like this. So I guess my first question, actually going back to like what I was talking about the cast, et cetera, or the cast of characters. So she's noted, especially in this novel, for shifting between the perspectives of different characters. So the novel is more or less an omniscient or a shifting third person narrative. Does it work for you, and how does it shape your experience as a reader?
It does work for me. I think it would not work. If I'm to go about the question in this way, it would not work with one perspective, because that person was not involved in everything. And so in order to shift and understand what someone is going through or what they're doing, I think you need to be able to move about freely. I'm trying to think about the last time, because I feel like we recently did another novel like this. But yeah, it works out and it's not jarring because it's pretty clear, mm-hmm. you know, who is currently in this particular perspective. Yes, I think without having the different perspectives, I would have had a lack of understanding and a lack of empathy for some of the characters, in particular, I think Elena, because let's say it was all in Mia's perspective or Pearl's. Well, Pearl's would have been skewed in Elena's favor. But with Mia, I think you would have definitely seen Elena as a villain.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's already borderline an antagonist, but once you see some of her, and it doesn't delve in so deeply, like Ying does not make it so that she's completely absolved of all the things that she did, but you get enough pieces of Mrs. Richardson's past that you understand where some of this is coming from. Again, I am not absolved, you know, of her treatment of Izzy and things like that, especially, I mean, she has an awakening at the very end.
Yeah.
Realizing that Izzy basically is her, or her, if she had taken the path and gone with mm-hmm. her boyfriend who asked her to. So yeah, I think it helps with empathy and understanding, certainly.
Yeah. Lessons in Chemistry was the book that
kept like we recently did one.
Yeah, even to the point where we got the dog, remember?
That's right. 6:30.
I agree with you. I like the shifting perspectives. It's actually a really good novel if you're studying point of view and perspective, because when we're in the head, we're following the perspective of, say, Mia. We're only through Mia, so we're seeing kind of not only the emphasis, but kind of the bias through her lens. And then when we see Elena, it's the same thing, right? So we're getting those different perspectives and sometimes multiple viewpoints on similar or the same events, which really is a really, to me, fascinating way to tell a story as opposed to being just a straight up omniscient narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because it brings more intrigue to the proceedings, because you know that when you're reading a chapter that's told from the point of view of, say, Izzy or Lexi, you're only getting part of the story, so you're intrigued to find out what the other parts are, and you're also trying to fill in the blanks of the context and what's being left out. And I think as a reader, that makes the novel way more engaging, because you are not as passive as you could be if it was just simply a first person narrator or just a flat omniscient narrator. So that's what I did like about it. Yet a really good point about Elena, because one of the things driving her is this regret that she gave up what would have been a way more to her interesting lifestyle, way more successful lifestyle as a journalist. She's a journalist, but she works for like the local paper, which is like, you know, the Shaker Heights paper. So it's not we're not talking the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times or anything, but she had an opportunity for something like that and settled down with her husband and then had the four kids. And I like that we're getting that she comes to that realization at the end too. But I also agree with you. Ing goes out of her way to not make her a bitter villain of a person, like, you know, because she's obviously jealous in some level of Mia. Did you pick up on that too?
Oh yeah, I think there's definitely either jealousy or envy,
mm-hmm.
because of Mia's ability to be an itinerant artist, because of how easy it is for Mia to relate to I'll say in quotations, you know, the difficult child that she has, you know, and she has such a great relationship with Pearl. I would say those are the two big ones that I spot. Yeah.
But it's interesting too, is once you start to find out the truth about Mia's upbringing, it's not so much that she goes she goes around in search for inspiration is partially true, because she's obviously also never staying in one place so that she can't be found by the the Wrights, I believe is the name of the family that she was supposed to have Pearl right. for. So I found that aspect interesting. It's also very believable too, you know, that
I think the Ryans, isn't it?
The Ryans, yeah.
Because I think the Wrights are her family.
Oh yeah, the Wrights are her family. The Ryans. There's a lot of people in this book. Those people show up too. But no, yeah, because like the idea that she, the free spiritedness of it, the artistic aspect of it, but in her picking up kind of like not odd jobs, but very like low paying, like kind of under the radar jobs to support her and her daughter. You know, I think it's very realistic of two people on the run. Mia being kind of on the run, and the fact that she kind of, you know, did what she did, but I never got the sense that she was like overly paranoid or something, like, you know, like mom acts weird about things and stuff. I mean, she's quirky and she has like certain things, but you never get the chance that Mia's like always looking over her shoulder. And I think that after, what was it, 15 years, it makes a lot of sense that you would be a little less hypervigilant about things. And you could tell she wanted to settle down. And I thought that was a really interesting thing about her character and the way that she contrasted with Elena. So we're going to get into like the mother-daughter relationships, obviously, because it's like pretty much the whole book, right? It's sibling relationships. It's so much mother-daughter relationships. This might as well be like a Joy Luck Club type of novel, we'll do that one day. But the other thing that's going on is that you have all that, but you also have the town, and the setting is really, really important. What I find interesting is that Shaker Heights was a planned community, right? And Ng grew up there. In fact, there's this really, when I was poking around for inspiration for questions and stuff, there was a book club guide through the publisher that you can get through her website for the book. And I was, there's an interview with her, and she was saying how, like, you know, she grew up there, and it was very, very privileged in many ways. And she's like kind of going back there and researching, et cetera. She made a joke about going to a diner, the local diner, to, you know, make sure the fries were just as good as she remembered, you know, in the name of research and stuff like that, which I found funny. What was, I was interesting though, was that it's a very, like when we think about suburbs that were planned, right? And we have both read, we did Raisin in the Sun, and we both have read the book, The Color of Law, which we, I think it was on episode 110, we did reference briefly. We were talking about books that were, you know, kind of formative for us in certain ways. This, so you think of that very, very true, and now it's become kind of like, not a cliche, but almost like the template for the criticism of the suburbs, was that they were created to be, they were not just, they were cookie cutter, and cookie cutter for white people, and the systemic racism that was perpetuated through things like covenants and homeowners associations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All that happened. And I never knew really anything about Shaker Heights, Ohio. So going in, when I heard about this planned community and everything, I was like, oh, it's that type of community. And then looking at the history, it's actually the complete opposite. So like in the 40s, after the war, you have Levittown. There's a couple in a different states, and there's one on Long Island, right? Because that's where I grew up near, which was the planned community. And Levitt, who was the name of the developer, kept black people out. You know, it was essentially a whites only type of place. Here, it's Shaker Heights is integrated in encouraging its diversity. Does it work as a, like, is it as you, it obviously it's not as utopian as it's trying to make itself out to be. Like, where are you seeing the flaws? And then how does that influence the way race is viewed or presented in the novel?
Yeah, it's interesting because I read this, then I watched the show, and then of course years have passed, and I was not unpleasantly surprised by Kerry Washington being cast as Mia, because I thought, wow, that wasn't the reading I had necessarily. And I thought, oh, did I miss something? But when you go through, because now I was like very much looking to see if anything, but it is clear that they are white, if only because at the abortion clinic, Lexi says that they're sisters. And so the fact that the nurse does kind of look at them, I think that is the only thing that pulls them. So it is really interesting to switch that up, because then we had even more layers to discuss and investigate when you now have Black characters in this particular role, especially she becomes a maid. You got all of these things. Yeah, so the dynamics completely change, which made it really interesting. So I'm glad that they did. I just want to be clear. I just said that, oh wow, that, you know, that wasn't the read I had, but this, like, it's a completely different thing, and that makes it really powerful. So it's interesting that, yeah, it is a bunch of white people, and race is in the background to a certain extent, because I think it's more about class, but it keeps rearing its head in really powerful ways. The Lexi and Brian thing, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Brian's Black.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. And she makes it. I would almost say that maybe Lexi is virtue signaling a little bit. Mm-hmm. In talking about, like, oh, it doesn't matter, look at me and Brian, dot dot dot, wouldn't our babies be so cute, you know, things like that. And then of course you have the BB of it all, I guess I'll say, and just how she is treated, and then how the custody battle comes into play, and the culture and all of that stuff. So I'm afraid I've lost track of the question.
No, you're on there with the whole, how race is presented in the novel, okay. But like, kind of like Shaker Heights is it wants to be a utopia, but the cracks are there.
Yeah.
It's like, what's your take on the neighborhood?
Yeah. I think the utopia is as white as it can be. And this is how everything looks great and everyone is making money. It's the cracks, I think, that you're starting to see are the people who might not fit into that socioeconomic strata. Uh-huh. And then sometimes it's also people of color who are not fitting into that. I think about the downstairs neighbor who is subletting. I can't remember his name, but he was also Asian.
Yes.
And then, yes, I couldn't tell you about Brian's family what their status was necessarily, but it's clear that it's almost like a flashlight is being shown on anyone who doesn't fall within a particular box. Mm-hmm. And everyone wants to say that they're open-minded, but it seems like they have their own way of doing things, and if you step outside of that, then they'll be unhappy about it, and that often comes down to race.
Yeah. The casting of Kerry Washington as Mia, and then her daughter, who, you know, so you have a person of color playing Pearl. It would have been interesting to see, like, how that played out with Pearl and Lexi, and Pearl as, you know, a person of color as opposed to a white teenager. When you're discussing Brian's parents, I want to say that somewhere early in the novel, he compares them to the Huxtables. You know, I apologize for bringing up the name, but, you know, the Cosby Show, mm-hmm. Because in that show, Cliff was a doctor and Claire was a lawyer. And so he has two fairly successful professional working parents, which is one of the reasons his parents are never home. And the two of them are all over there quite a bit, they are, you know, getting it on and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's a great point that you made about how race is kind of like always in the background and flies up, because the thing about, you have the BB of it all and you have that trial, and we can get into kind of the motherhood side of that a little later. What I caught several times though was like the way Linda so badly deals with the culture of Mei Lin, right? Like she, it's like this weird performative and it's like a casual racism. You know, we're reading this book and the book is like notoriously problematic because it's got like stereotypical, you know, Chinese, like old stereotypical Chinese looking people. And kind of like there were a couple of old Dr. Seuss books that were like that have been since taken out of print. Or she's like, we're gonna decorate with Asian inspired art and things like that. Like to so she knows her, it's this weird, privileged white way of looking at things. And I thought it was done very realistically because I've met people like that who would you call them out on it and they would tell you they're not racist, but they're being insensitive in some way or another by what they're doing, you know, et cetera. And I thought, and then the whole thing, I think it was the whole thing with the doll, that it, in fact, in her interview in the book club packet, Aang mentions that in, it was like 96 or 97, like around the time that it takes place, the American Girl doll company finally started coming out with multiracial and multicultural dolls. And she said that her mom bought her the doll, even though she was like a teenager, like she was way too old to have the dolls, but her mom was like, this is important and I'm gonna buy it for you anyway. But you know, she's so Linda's like ca keeps Linda can't get her out of her own like kind of privileged head, and we see that come up in a way that is like really really important, really sours her character. And I thought that was very, I thought it was actually very well done because it's Linda is a very believable character, not as a villain per se, because I don't think she would portray herself as a villain. Or believe herself, you know. Well, I mean, what was your take on Linda and the her wanting to, you know, raise the kid and everything, and her approach to the kid's obvious race and heritage?
Yeah, I think that it is someone who has the best of intentions, but doesn't fully understand what that means and the weight of it. And I think it gets to, and it's funny because I think there was even a quote in the book about this. You know, it calls back our discussion from Flowers in the Attic about, you know, who is a mother? And you know, does it come down to biology or is it, you know, something else? Love, I think, is what the quote was in the book. And so the McCulloughs, again, because we had that perspective, right? Linda was born without a uterus, so she was unable to bear any children. And I think they had tried other avenues, and so this just seems like a godsend that this child appears and needs a home. And so they love it fiercely, and they recognize, yes, that it would be a part of a different culture. And so, well, what does that mean? And it's a bit silly, and I think it reminds me of an Atlanta episode. I'm pretty sure it was Atlanta, where there was like a white couple that collected all this African art and like felt like they were experts on it. I'm pretty sure it was Atlanta because it was definitely satirical. But it reminded me of that because at one point they said, "Oh yeah, we've gotten some Asian art," and I'm like, "Oh my gosh!" But you know, to a certain extent, they feel like that is the way, and they're trying. You know, they take her to an Asian restaurant every week, I think it was something like that. So it seems silly, I think, from the outside, but I think also sometimes with caregivers of a different culture, you are scrambling and trying to figure out what does this look like? How can I help this child? And I want to love them, and also you know, I do recognize that they're missing out on part of themselves, and so how do I help them with that? But they were just going about it in well, an unguided way, or misguided, I should say. And unfortunately, you know, it all came out in that courtroom, so everything's heated. So I think it is one of those the best intention sort of thing, but when it starts to get ugly, then I have to pull back, and I can't give her as much grace. You know, the rumor that OBB, because she became overweight because, and then you find Bibi's perspective of, well, she was depressed and she was eating and stressed and eating a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And then she got food poisoning. But Linda thought, oh, well, what if she was pregnant and then she got an abortion, you know, all of that. So once it gets dirty, I feel like you can't do too much. And I feel like Linda also was maybe not extending as much grace and empathy as I'm extending Linda currently, because it was all about demonizing Bibi. And not really stepping out and understanding, because I think these people are affluent. And so I think it's hard for them to understand that someone is unable to make a living wage. And so they have to give up the baby in order, hopefully that baby finds a better home. And then she finds stability and she wants to have that baby back. So yeah, I don't completely, again, you know, villainize her. I think all of these are just flawed human beings, which is why I think I love this book so much, because they are realistic and definitely just like Julius Caesar, you know, we have to hold people accountable. But yeah, I think I am able to extend, again, empathy with her and give her the benefit of the doubt that they were trying the best that they could.
Yeah, there's a desperation on the part of Linda, too, as the trial goes on. And you're right. The privilege is, they're dripping with privilege, partially because I don't think they could conceive the idea that somebody wouldn't want them to raise the kid, because of the good they're doing for it, even though Linda really just does want to be a mother as well. So I have compassion for her, but at the same time, yeah, you're right. She's complicated and it's complicated, but it also does show the kind of that fallacy, that liberal, the white liberal, you know, open-mindedness that is still very entrenched in the problematic practices and systemic practices and things like that. And it's really interesting to me of how sneaky Linda and Elena are with discovering the truth about things. Like, you know, it's just a more precise, maybe stronger version of like neighborhood gossip, you know, and Elena, being an investigative journalist at one point, starts digging in. Linda's jumping to a lot of conclusions. And I think there's other assumptions that are made, which, it's like if they'd sit down and talk to each other, we'd get kind of the truth about things. But at the same time, that's not how the world works, you know? Mm-hmm. So the idea that people are keeping secrets from one another, or that there's things that are being kind of like twisted a little bit to fit a narrative, and then we have to discover what the truth is behind all that, I think that I thought that was very, very realistic and very well done as well. I don't know, like, did you take a side in the Mei-Ling, Mirabelle thing? I mean, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
And I know that Mia's motivation for basically planting the idea that Bibi go and take the baby, even though we can debate whether or not she wanted her to do that, but Bibi just kind of like went ahead and did it. The motivation for that is the fact that she ran off with Pearl, and so it's like she wouldn't want somebody's other daughter taken from her. But like, I don't know, did you have a side in this? What was your...
Yeah, it really is complex. Mm-hmm. I feel like I typically lean towards, when it's not in a toxic situation, you know, giving it back to the birth mother. I think because she found herself in more stable situation, that it should have gone back to her. I guess they don't really get into finances at all in the court, but this is the whole issue. If I were to get on a very tiny soapbox, this is the whole issue with, you know, I'll just say America, really decrying these low birth rates, because you want babies, but you are unwilling really to help people out to, you know, take care of them. Especially certain communities, and in fact, I would say minority communities. So I just felt like, oh man, this is just a picture perfect of the fact that she is unable to. I think the wage, it was low. I wish I could pull it up, but I mean, I don't even know where she was living and how to take care of, but it seemed like she started to earn more money and she was saving up, and it seemed like it was a bit better. And I know that medically there were some issues, but again, that goes back to did she have insurance, you know, that she could maybe talk to a lactation specialist and work with the baby because the baby was not latching and then BB's milk dried up. So I just felt like, man, if there was more assistance, then I think BB's story would not have been filled with such trials and tribulations. So I do lean towards her. But, you know, I do recognize, you know, the other side is, you know, they were able to find this baby. But if you think about it, I mean, the McCall is basically like fostered, which sometimes fostering leads to adoption. Sometimes fostering, like they might move to another foster or they might age out of that particular system. So to a certain extent, it was almost like they were fostering in order to get her back to health and then give her back to the parent. So I feel like in that long-winded answer with my tiny soapbox, that BB probably is where I would lie. And she had a support system, you know, she had Mia, so it's not like she was completely alone. I am surprised that Mia wasn't called to the stand. I would have liked to have seen more. I mean, this is not a courtroom drama book, but I think there's just more that could have been fleshed out about that. I think bringing up finances, I think, would have been something that the McCulloughs would have benefited from, and that would have been interesting to see BB's side, what she is doing, how much she is making and things like that. And then, bringing in a character witness or something like that in Mia, I think that would have been interesting.
I agree with you, like, on all the points, because it's not this open and shut, let's criticize one side and lionize the other. It's very complicated, and they're both, all the characters involved in it are flawed. Right. And it would have been interesting to see a little bit more of the finances come in. It's clear that in addition to struggling to literally survive with Mei Ling, BB is probably has some PPD, you know, postpartum depression or something, like, you know, which is something, this is 1997, 98. So it's acknowledged, but it seems that, like, it's only been within the last, maybe in the 2000s into the current day, that a lot more has come out and been looked into as far as, like, postpartum depression and treatment for things and taking women's mental health a lot more seriously than it had been. The 90s weren't like the dark ages by any chance, but a community like Shaker Heights, where kind of these problems are kept under the surface as best they can, certainly did exist. What's interesting too to me, by the way, by the end of the book, the McCulloughs are in the process of adopting a baby. Yeah. Like, they're looking
from China.
Yeah. So which was very, very typical of the time, because I know there were a lot of babies adopted from China, especially girls, because of the, I don't remember when China got rid of the one child rule, it was called, or something, or the two child rule. But, you know, so there was kind of a discarding is not the best word for it, but, like, you know, you have a very patriarchal system. So the idea that, like, you know, a son was really important, but a daughter was kind of, you know, I don't know the statistics on adoption of Chinese babies, but I want to say the majority of them were girls. And so that whole thing is interesting. And I've seen at least one documentary, by the way, about people from the United States who were born in China and adopted as children to mostly white families, searching for their Chinese birth parents, because it is not easy. There's, like, literally people who, like, make a living helping other people do that. So anyway, tangent over. What do you think of Elena as a mother, and, like, who she favors, who she doesn't, how she treats, like, each of the kids?
Yeah, if we were to have a spectrum, I feel like, well, maybe I won't go there, because I guess it could be, but I am critical of her mothering, how she mothers. I am unsure where this guy, a lot of it does seem like it might be nurture. I don't know how much of a sense we get from her family, but just from the background that I can recall about, you know, in college and things like that, she did seem like a rule follower, etc. Well, Lexi, I think she has high expectations for Lexi. Lexi is, she expects her to be, I think, how she is now, how Elena is now. Like, mm-hmm. that is what she would hope she would become. Trip, she even says that he is shallow. Like, that's near the end when she finds out everything. Like, sort of her lovable, shallow boy, which is unfortunate that even your parent doesn't see the depths that you might carry.
Yeah.
And Moody and Izzy, I think, both walk to the beat of their own drum, and she allows that. And I think it's easier for her maybe to get along with Moody than she is with Izzy. And Izzy, I think, just has this really super strong sense of justice. And so if she feels like there's any inequality going on or injustice, for example, you know, the orchestra situation mm-hmm. that you had been talking about, then she'll go after it, though she doesn't maybe have a good grasp of the golden mean by Aristotle necessarily, you know.
Yeah.
Because she does, her extremes are, yeah, they're a yeah. bit like breaking a well, bow is maybe yeah. a bit too much, though she is encouraged by Mia to do the whole yeah. Toothpick in each of the locks thing. So yeah, I think Elena hopes maybe that motherhood should be easy. And I think it was easy for her first two, and then it kind of went downhill from there. Yeah. And she struggles with that. And I think she doesn't recognize until the very end, maybe why she was struggling so much with Izzy. As I said, you know, she had this awakening that, you know, Izzy's is her really, or who she was or who she could have been. So does she do the best she can? Maybe. I definitely think she's falling short in several areas, just with how she speaks to and about Izzy and her feelings that come through about her, that I don't know how much love she actually has for Izzy. And then, yeah, she just has these expectations, I think, for herself that she puts on her children. So she might, I mean, do the best that she has been taught to, but she's definitely not the best of mothers.
I mean, Izzy's what, 14, 15. So the idea that she wouldn't be able to see a Aristotelian golden mean makes yeah. sense, right?
Because yeah.
that age, you're not exactly learned or trained in nuance. Oh, yeah, Elena, I wouldn't go as far as to call her a narcissistic parent, because no. I think she does care. Narcissistic parents purport to care for their children, but like, I think she does genuinely love her children, and she's not always putting herself first or making or manipulating things so that she's the center of attention, because the kids do have their own lives and she prides and interferes. I think she's very immature though as a parent. And you're right. Some of that might be because of her upbringing. Maybe she feels like she has four kids, right? So there's, mm-hmm. like a void she's trying to fill. Is there something missing in her life? She's never been able to fully handle things the way that you would expect somebody, you know, with that much experience at that age to do. And it's too late, because it eventually becomes too late because Izzy runs away. And she, you're right, she doesn't realize until after at all that who Izzy is and how much she's like her, which makes it even sadder on her part. Even though she learns a lesson. I don't know how much she changes by the end of the novel. I mean, she seems determined to find Izzy, and I know she's determined to kind of get them all back on their feet and be the mother, But I don't want to say she's gone through a drastic change in personality by the end of the book. I feel that she's very humbled by everything, but the leaf being turned over is not a huge one. It's a fairly small one. Am I off base with that assessment of her as a character?
Yeah, I think just because she had a wake-up call doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, because of this, maybe coda, I guess we could call it at the end. Like, who knows what that's going to be? Because even Izzy is saying, I might be found, but I'll leave again. Like, there's going to need... There will be required many intense discussions, I think, between the two of them. And of course, the initial one is going to be of anger. So yeah, a tiny leaf potentially, or maybe nothing. Maybe the realization is just it. And then she's still PO'd and she keeps on doing what she's doing.
Yeah. And Mia as a mother. She did what she did. Like, first of all, her motivation for taking Pearl the way she did. And then, like, Pearl does stick with her in the end. Pearl does not run away. Like, what's your take on her as a mother? And then almost as, like, a, pun intended, a surrogate mother to some of the Richardson children. She kind of becomes that as well.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think?
Let me ask you a question, because you just said her motivation for doing what she did. What was her motivation?
Part of me wants to say she realized that she wanted the baby and the situation was not good. Like, she's like, what have I gotten myself into? And she had regret, and then she went ahead and left, etc. But at the same time, I'm not entirely sure. And I want to say that a big part of it was Warren's death,
mm-hmm.
and that she's grieving Warren's death, and she's in this situation, and maybe because he's dead and she has nobody else to be that close to, but she has this opportunity with the baby that she's carrying, and maybe that can fill the Warren-sized hole in her heart. What do you think?
Yeah, that this was the weakest part for me, to be honest, because there was really no transition to get to her keeping the baby. It was, she was at the funeral. She wasn't even allowed to go to the funeral. Her parents see her in her pregnant state, and she says, you know, it's not what it thinks. Not what it looks like, or whatever it was. And you know, she explains everything, and the parent, I can't recall which one. Oh, I think it was must have been the mother about, you know, selling your own child, tisk, and like walks up and all of that. And then she leaves, she takes stuff, she takes the rabbit, and the rabbit is in the car, and goes, and then she decides to, yeah, she writes the note to the Ryans, and that's that. And I thought there was no explanation as to why we had this particular transition. And so that was, you have to read a lot, I think, between the lines. I can get with your explanation about Warren. I think that might be the strongest one, given the fact that her father said, well, we were told right after her mother walked out that this was a frequent occurrence, that her mother would become upset and walk off, and her father would tell Mia, you know, give her some time, and then not necessarily all was well, but certainly that they could get back to whatever they were doing. And so that seems like it's typical. It's so I couldn't say that was the reason that suddenly she felt shame, because she kept talking to different people and they were like, I could never do that, but she was completely content getting that $10,000, and you know, and she was supported by Hawthorne and her partner to a certain extent. So yeah, I think Warren might be the best explanation, but I do think that was the weakest part of it. So then I guess your question is about what I think of her as a mother, and
and it's just like a surrogate to the Richardson children, because she's for at least a couple of them, Izzy and Lexi especially.
It's really interesting how someone who I don't know. You know, is so young. I mean, I guess she would have been maybe 19 or 20.
Yeah, thereabouts.
Just easily falls into that particular role, and having a child maybe initially out of shame because of that, and have, you know, so maybe not for the best reason, right? And having stolen, then becomes this, yeah, really beautiful mother, and how she and her daughter relate to each other. And I think because Mia has been through some trials and tribulations, both as an adult as well as a young adult, that she is able to relate, and she has this like world experience, whereas all these other people in are living in this idyllic world where, you know, bad things don't necessarily happen, and they've, you know, had, they've lived in the lap of luxury. They've not had any struggles, but here you had someone who've dealt with all sorts of things, living in her car, all of that stuff, constant moving, that she is able to relate to people in different levels. Even if she didn't have an abortion, she's able to comfort Lexi in a way that I think Elena would be unable to, because I think there would have been a lot of shame if Lexi had gone to her own mother. It's interesting because if you pull back, you kind of feel like Mia is Bibi to a certain extent, you know, because there's a lot of judgment against Bibi endangering her child, leaving her there and everything. And some people would potentially judge Mia for having her child live out of a car, you know, and constantly moving and having no consistency or home base. And so I think that there's that link together, which is, I think, why Mia has, one of the reasons why Mia has such a close relationship with Bibi as well. So yeah, it's lovely how she's able to relate to so many people. And I think which is why that, you know, Kerry Washington's, I will say that I have not seen many Kerry Washington things. I know that people do recommend Scandal to me. So that was probably the first thing that I had maybe like lengthwise and depthwise seen her in. And it is so powerful. And I think having that, that be the casting really is able to tie a lot of this stuff together and delve into a lot of these themes in a deeper way than if we stuck with the original reading of it being a white person. Not to say that white people don't struggle, but I think that it, you know, I think that it does add some more nuance to it.
It does. It works very well for television, and you're casting somebody as talented as Kerry Washington, who's going to do a good job with the material too. That's the other thing about when they start playing with the casting for things, you know, like you've switched the gender or the race or something of a character in the novel, which I'm all for, but I always have the caveat is that the person has to put in a good performance, right? Like, you know, I would hate to have the character change and then they choose an actor or actress who's just terrible at it. It's like, so anyway, what strikes me about Mia and Elena too, in contrasting, is that Mia is very compassionate and people go to her with secrets. Right? Bibi and Lexi, even Izzy to a certain extent. Even ironically, Pearl's keeping things from her mother, but that's a teenage daughter. Whereas Elena is all about exposing secrets. So like, me will keep them, me will help them. Elena is going around trying to find Mia's secrets and air them, air the dirty laundry, because of, you know, we talked about her regret over things, that she's mad at Elena, at Mia for encouraging Bibi to, you know, helping her with the custody thing. I mean, there's a whole laundry list of things, but I just found that really, really interesting. And Mia, though, I hate to say this, Mia is not the most dynamic character out of all of them. And I think that the one thing I think that did bother me about the book and especially the ending, was the whole bit of her leaving the pictures behind, because it was a little too like Mary Poppins or something, like, you know, and this is what you symbolize, and this is what you symbolize, because all the pictures are like artworks or the things are superimposed on one another, and everything's symbolic. And each of them gets kind of what the symbolism is. And it's very on the nose and it's a nicely written scene. But it took me out a little bit because I was like, it just seems Mia's coming off as sort of the fairy godmother type of person. What did you think about that very ending where all the Richardsons find the photos that Mia left behind?
And it's all like super abstract because I think it's like a pad, an athletic pad there. Yeah. And I think the abortion pink slip is there.
Yes, the pink slip from the abortion clinic.
Guess I did think it odd. I definitely speed read through that. I was like, oh yeah, she left some stuff. And everyone kind of gets a sense of maybe what she thought of them. But she didn't even interact with Trip ever.
No.
So it is a bit odd to kind of have that. Yeah, I don't know. Because, I mean, is she doing that for everybody? You know, that the places that she didn't do that for BB.
Yeah.
And I don't, it's not necessary. Well, yeah, I don't know. I guess that she's trying to wake them up to a certain extent. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But it doesn't track necessarily for all of them. I think the Gilded Cage was maybe the only one. That was the one, I think, that woke Elena up to a certain extent. But
yeah,
she could have just left. She could have done a big, dropped a big bomb and it would have just been the abortion thing and in Lexi's handwriting. So yeah, I don't know. It's odd. I don't know that I necessarily have too much insight as to why she did it, to be honest.
And like I said, I'm nitpicking because the novel's a great book. And this was like one of the only things where I was like, it's just a little too much for me. I get where she's coming from with it, and she's trying to be compassionate and letting them know what she thought, letting them know, you know, kind of what the secret is or whatever it happens to be. And I appreciated that. I just thought it was a little too on the nose. But we're going to get into the kids in a second. I just, one little point I wanted to make, there's like no fathers in this book. They have a father, right? But he's like barely doing anything. He works, et cetera, et cetera. It's very centered around Elena. And you wonder if, her husband is Bill, right? You wonder if he, is even aware of half this stuff. 'Cause he's fairly absent. He's very much like the working dad, and he's a lawyer. So it's just kind of like a very stereotypical thing. It also leaves out the complication that would come with having to write another character in terms of the father. And this is a very mother-centered novel. Do you think the men got the short shrift in that regard, or did it even matter?
No, I think it's fine. I think it's, it reminds me of the, what is it, 1933 play, The Women. You know, you can just do with what you have. I think if this is one of the themes is about motherhood and what it looks like, I think that you keep with that. I think the only father that you needed was the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
Lim, I think his last name is Lim.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's mainly, I mean, it could have been a woman if you really wanted to, mm-hmm. but that he certainly, he brought his fatherhood into that, as he, you know, in the kind of backstory of what was happening. Yeah, I think it's completely fine. Any other father would have been Brian, and he wasn't ready for fatherhood, to be sure. Yeah. And then the conflict between Brian's parents about, you know, the disagreement about what should happen with the child. So I think it would just have muddied the waters to have any more. And I think any male figures that we saw they got enough screen time, I think, as it were.
Yeah. That's a great point. That's a great point overall. So getting into the teenagers, we have five of them. And if you really look at it, Ing starts with stereotypical, like tropey teenage characters. In fact, it doesn't match up exactly, but I put this note in our document. Moody's the brain, Lexi's the princess, Tripp's the athlete, and Pearl and Izzy are the basket case and the criminal. Izzy is also kind of a basket case. So Ing is giving us the Breakfast Club. And I'm not saying that in a derogatory way. I clocked that mainly because The Breakfast Club is like one of my favorite movies of all time. But I clocked how she grabbed these very stereotypical roles for teenagers. And so her challenge, if she's doing that, is to flesh the characters out and make them feel like real people as opposed to just the stereotypes, the categories. How well does she succeed? Does she succeed with all five of them? Are there some that are more developed than others? I mean, like, what is your, what do you think? Do they round out enough for you, or would you have liked to seen a little bit more from one or two of the other Richardson kids?
Well, first I'd like you to explain why Pearl is a basket case.
Ally Sheedy's character is this sort of, at the very beginning, this very introverted person. Like, so, like, she's, like, barely noticed at school. So, but also Izzy's very much the Ally Sheedy character. And, you know, so it kind of like falls apart a little bit, the metaphor, when you get to Izzy and Pearl, because neither, like, Izzy technically is the criminal because she sets the house on fire. But, like, Pearl's got that sort of reclusive, like, new girl. Everybody's ignoring her. I think she gets made fun of a couple of times, too. Basket case side of the side of the Ally Sheedy character. And then Izzy's got the weird girl side of it. Okay. I'm stretching. I'm making this fit, Stella. Okay. Don't take this away.
Yeah. That's fine. I'll take your word for it. Yeah, how well does she develop each of them?
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that if I were to go with the dimensional, I would say maybe they're two-dimensional instead of three-dimensional, because I think mm-hmm. they each have a particular characteristic that they start with, and then by the end they have another one, but I would say that they're not fully developed, as even a teenager is never fully developed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only really see them, well, I guess this is silly to say, but you can only really see them through somebody else's eyes. You never really, I think, fully understand them through their own perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
Because Tripp, I don't even know how many, I feel like we did not get too many POVs from him.
No,
just really him, not. I think, noticing Pearl officially and feeling that, you know, she was different than other, oh, you're so different than the other girls. But Pearl also, you know, but through Pearl you get to know Tripp a bit more, but through Moody and Elena you get a wrong idea of who Tripp is. So it is really interesting. And Lexi just seems like this prissy princess type, and then I think this abortion journey that she goes through really shifts her own perspective and changes her greatly. So I think they're as developed as time and space allows. I don't know that it would be possible to develop them further, to be honest, without it being like, oh wow, this is a lot of unnecessary information. But, you know, could I pick this person out and fully write, you know, a character summary of them? No, I think there'd be many gaps. So that's why I say 2D out of 3D.
I think that's a really great way to put it, you know, because we don't get much about Tripp, except that we get more depth out of him because of his relationship with Pearl, right? Izzy, yeah, we'll get to Izzy. I'll get to Izzy in a little bit. Moody's the brain with the crush, who is also hurting, right? But can't necessarily show it the same way Lexi can. I think the kids get some vulnerability that Elena necessarily doesn't see at first, or hasn't been really paying much attention to, that they are in pain in some way or another. All four of the kids that she has, and it's drawn out through these small and large tragedies that are happening, or these very adult complex situations, or whatever it happens to be. So I agree with you. Pearl is interesting because Pearl kind of goes in the opposite direction, where she becomes from somebody who's like reclusive, a little strange maybe, according to some of the other people in school, but she becomes more and more, for lack of a better word, normal, or strives to be more normal as she meets the Richardsons. Like, she's jealous in a way of them, but only because it's what she wants. She's what she thinks she wants out of life, at least for now, which is the comfort and stability of a family like that. And she loves her mother so much, and she obviously does not leave her mother's side and leaves with her at the end of the novel. But at the same time, these people, these kids get something her mother can't provide or hasn't been able to provide so far. So Pearl, I think, normalizes in the opposite direction. I get why Pearl has a crush on Trip. Why have her string Moody along, and why have her start the relationship with Trip?
Do you think she's stringing him along?
I don't think she realizes she kind of is, but I don't think she realizes she is.
It felt
Moody certainly thinks that she's
stringing. I know. Him. Yeah, it kind of feels like the classic, but you were nice to me. Situation, which unfortunately, you know, it seems like it's a generalization, but it happens more times than you think, where, you know, a girl is nice to you and you're like, she likes me. And so I think they, you know, they clicked really easily, Moody and Pearl, and that was her first friend, and he's a safe spot, and he was in the friend zone, and I guess he thought that, yeah. So in my opinion, I didn't think that she was stringing him along. But I guess that's, as teenagers, are you going to talk about setting boundaries? No, you're not an adult yet.
It's interesting that when, like, somebody older, say their 20s and their 30s is like, or even their older teens is, you were nice to me and now I'm going to assume that you like me.
Yep.
Moody's young, mm-hmm. right? So it's not, while it's not the best behavior to assume, there's some sort of like logic to it at that young of an age, when you have never really had feelings for anybody or had it reciprocated, and you have this friend and you develop this crush on her and you think there's a chance. So it's more innocent than that sort of incel toxic male, you smiled at me and you I believe you want to have sex with me, that sort of like really toxic thing. This, I believe, is a lot more innocent and kind of natural for a kid like Moody.
Yeah. So. Well, it's, I mean, guys also show their affection by beating you up, you know, picking on you.
Jesus Christ.
I meant, you know, picking on you, punching you in the pulling, arm,
pulling pigtails.
Yeah.
Right?
That sort of thing. Yeah, that's what I meant. Not a
I know.
Yeah. What was the original question? Why did she go for Trip?
Yeah, why? Well, I totally get why she had a crush for Trip and wanted to be with Trip. As the author, why have them have a sexual relationship?
Oh, why they have them have a sexual
relationship? Why do we have them hook up?
I see.
I mean, I totally get the crush, right? He's a really good looking athlete boy, and she's like, he's cute. Totally makes sense, but why consummate it?
I don't know. I mean, there was that whole section about like sex really was sort of fueling everything.
Yeah.
It seemed like, which all seemed to have started with Lexi having sex, and then it was just all this. And then Pearl was noticing innuendos. It seemed like the Monica Lewinsky scandal was going on at that time.
Yes, it was.
So there were jokes happening and all of that stuff. So I think it was almost an inevitability. And it is interesting when there's this section where Mia's like, I never had a physical sexual relationship with someone. I was like, oh my gosh. But her daughter had the painting series or the photograph series of what was it, child virgin, pregnant virgin,
I think so, yeah,
mother virgin, something like that. So I think it was just kind of in the water, and they're teenage. I don't know.
It's, well, that feels too, like a bad right? answer, yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know that. It was just like, does it, what does it do for the plot? Like, is it,
yeah, well, I think the main thing it does for the plot is then it creates this tension of, oh boy, was it really Pearl who was pregnant?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Cause otherwise, well, if they hadn't been hooking up, then that mystery would have been solved rather quickly, but then that creates just a bunch of, I mean, it creates conflict. Obviously it breaks her and Moody up, and then Elena's on a tear and all that stuff.
Yeah. I'm not going to get too much. You already mentioned Lexi here and there and how she's more vulnerable and things. The other thing I think I felt bad for her was how she ended up leaning on Mia as a mother figure. And the only reason I felt bad for her about that is that her mother should be a mother figure. And she's detached from all of that in a sense. Like, she can't trust her own mother to really handle things the way she wants to handle, or at least to be a compassionate listening voice, where Mia and Pearl were like, you're going to stay over here and we're going to give you the clothes. Like, we'll cover for you. We will nurse you back to health because you're exhausted. Her mother would have been, Elena would have been really judgmental. And Pearl, yeah. Not Pearl, Lexi knew that. So it kind of broke my heart a little bit that she can't have that relationship with her own mother and she's finding it outside. So.
Yeah. And I mean, she says, maybe one day I'll tell her. But as I said, you know, before, I think that, yeah, Elena would have really gone after that from a shame angle rather than a comforting angle.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Izzy. So Izzy's the one who sets the fires. Izzy's the one who runs away. Izzy's the one who is the back in high school, when I was in high school in the early 90s, we used to refer to the kind of look as alternative, right? Stockings, black Doc Martens, that sort of, like, you know, she's the closest thing that the Richardson family has to a rebel. And so I have a two-part question. First, there's a poem that she mentions called This Be the Verse. And she chooses it to sum up her life. And I'm going to read the poem. It's by Philip Larkin. It's not a very long poem. But content warning, it does have cursing in it. So the poem goes, they fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old style hats and coats who half the time were sloppy, stern, and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. So it's almost limericky in a sense. It's a little humorous. Is it accurate as far as, like, Izzy's like, this is like the summary of my life? Is Izzy just being sort of an overdramatic teenager when she says that? And do you feel that Izzy was a well-developed enough character to be the one who, pun intended, sparks the big change at the end of the novel?
Is she the one that...
She's the one that sets the fires.
Yes.
So do you think, like... Do you think that Ing developed her enough?
Oh, to be the one?
Yeah.
Yes. Because of everything else that she had gotten into, I think Ing does develop her well enough, because we see this strong sense of justice and that she does have a vengeful spirit. She's definitely a Batman sort of person. And she takes that, the idea of sometime, oh, the anecdote that Mia had about sometimes fires, you know, afterwards in a farm or whatever, something better comes along afterwards because the soil is more rich, that sort of thing. And so I think in Burning, which is definitely the vengeful part, I'm hoping that when I look at it, I think, oh, it was just for her to burn it. My hopeful thought is that she would like her family to start over again, but I don't know that she's that mature necessarily, that she was thinking that far ahead. I think she was just thinking about the fire part, not necessarily the rebuilding with more fertile soil. And what was the first part?
It was the whole thing with the poem. She says, "This is my life." I mean,
yeah. I think that's true for her. I think that's her truth. So whether that's, I mean, it seems dramatic. She might be messed up because of her parents. That might be true. So I would say it's like a yes and situation.
Okay.
Yeah.
There were times where I felt that she wasn't the most developed. Like there were times where I was like, maybe she's a little too stereotypical of an angry teenager. But I also feel that she grows a little bit toward as the novel goes on. And maybe at the beginning of the book, she would have thought of running away the way that she did, or just would have been on the dramatic side, but she sees that she sees like a need to do it by the end. And I think so it does come to kind of a good conclusion there. The setting the fires, you know, it kind of gives us a metaphorical take on the, a literal and then a metaphorical take on the title, because she sets little fires everywhere and they blow into this big conflagration. And of course, metaphorically speaking, all the problems in the novel for all the characters are little fires that kind of blow up to something collectively bigger. Yeah, it was just like kind of went back and forth on her as a character. I really liked her character, but at the same time, I felt like I just would have wanted to see a little bit more of her here and there. I felt that there were times, especially when like Lexi was front and center in the Warren household, that Izzy was being kind of nudged out of the story. But at the same time, it tracked for me because Lexi would have not nudged Izzy out of the situation too, because that's who Lexi is. And Izzy, I think, is always ushered from the room and things like that. So Ng does a pretty good job with telling the story. All right. So I got like one more question about the book itself, and then just kind of a tangent question just for funsies. And then the final question. So the last question about the book, what do you think happens to these characters? Because you could write a sequel to this novel.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she will down the line somewhere, set it several years into the future. What do you think happens like to some of them? To me and Pearl, or to Elena, Lexi, does Izzy ever come back? Do they ever find her? Like, you know, what happens when she gets to Pittsburgh? Like that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that Trip has a breakdown of some sort. Mm-hmm. I think maybe he becomes a bit depressed and I'm unsure. He kind of seems like the type of guy who might not go to college, but will stay in the town and work somehow. Moody, I think the reason why I think he'll become, because I think that relationship meant a lot to both of them. I think that was a touchstone in his life. So that's why I think with her leaving, it'll be hard for him. Moody, who is already going through something, I could see him distancing himself from the family in a similar way that Izzy has. He's a writer, right? Or is he kind of also an artist? I can't remember.
I think he's a writer.
Yeah. Okay. So I could see him, you know, doing a fine arts program, something like that. Lexi, I think, definitely needs to get away. I think, what was her plan? Stanford, or was hers Yale? Oh, hers was Yale.
Yale.
I wonder if she'll make it. Cause I think she's definitely going through some, depression as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she didn't even get in on her own merit, cause Pearl wrote that essay, is a bit of an issue. So I do wonder if she, might drop out and maybe after that, she and her mother will have a heart to heart as to what's going on and go from there. Izzy, it would be nice if she's able to find Mia and Pearl, because it seemed like she was going to Pittsburgh. So she's going to see the Wrights, which is super weird. Just like this strange kid showing up at a parent's house, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I guess she can speak highly of me. I mean, she might be a good mediary to bring the rights back together. But it would be nice to see what that would like. And I feel like she could definitely, because I think she was also going to go see that agent who was selling the art.
Yeah.
So I could see her pursuing art, not as a degree, I think probably as, you know, an apprentice and moving up from there. Mia and Pearl, I hope they settle down at some point, maybe reconciling with the Ryans, because that would be really interesting to see what that conflict and resolution would look like. Elena, I don't know. It seems like because of this reawakening and whether or not she turned over this leaf, will she become unsettled with her current life as a small town journalist and mother and maybe seek something else? And yeah, I think those are the big characters, right?
Yeah, I think Elena runs the risk of ending up very, very lonely when the kids get to the point where they're ready to leave. And I'm hoping that what Mia did here sparks something in her to try to mend what's happened so that she does not get abandoned by her children. Because she's already been abandoned by one of them, and the other three are kind of hanging on by a thread. And I don't know if she has the maturity to develop an adult relationship with her children without being who she's always been. So that would be an interesting way to see how that family dynamic plays out, especially when they're trying to literally rebuild their lives. I think you're right about Lexi and Tripp and the mental health issues. And since this was the 90s and the early 2000s, the idea of going right into therapy is not as common, you know? People went to therapy, but I don't think, you know, especially if you're a mother like Elena, who's image conscious in the way she is, oh no, we don't talk about these things. That's sort of like taboo of therapy. So it may take a while for Lexi and Tripp to fully feel better. I would also imagine that Lexi gets some sort of imposter syndrome when she gets to Yale because Pearl wrote the essay for her. And in that case, she was using Pearl, you know, so she was never like her friend. She was just using her for it. With the having Pearl help her with the abortion, I felt was there was a little more genuine motivation there. Like she knew she could trust Pearl as opposed to just kind of I'm using you for this. But yeah, I think she'll go to Yale, and she, like, knowing this in the back of her mind and the secret she's kept about these things, she's going to feel like a real imposter, and that'll be part of whatever breakdown or whatever growth she needs to have. Izzy, I feel, is like following whatever lead she can, and she's trying to find Mia, and the two that she has are, you know, the Ryans and the Wrights. So it's like, maybe she does find them. Because I don't know where Pearl and Mia go. Are they going to go look for Pearl for Mia's parents, or are they going to go hide again? Are they going to go reconcile with the Ryans? You know, it's kind of up in the air. I like that it's kind of up in the air because we can do our little headcanon and speculate what happens to these characters. So I'm kind of hoping Ing writes something with these characters again.
Mm.
Just to get some of those questions answered. So this is a little fun. In the book club guide, Ing says she created a playlist and she lists some of the songs. The songs are all very 90s. They're all from the 90s, a couple from the 80s. We have, she also links to a Spotify playlist. And in fact, she gives like each character a theme. It's kind of interesting. So here is the list of songs that is on the Spotify playlist for Celeste Ng, that Celeste Ng created for the novel. And I'll link to this in the show notes. So we have the Julianne Hatfield 3 Spin the Bottle, Insane in the Brain by Cypress Hill, Good Intentions by Toad the Wet Sprocket, What's Up by Four Non-Blondes, Hand in My Pocket by Alanis Morissette, Pleasant Valley Sunday by the Monkees, 1979 by the Smashing Pumpkins, Mo Money, Mo Problems by the Notorious B.I.G., Kiss Me by Sixpence None the Richer, Ask by the Smiths, Top of the World by the Carpenters, Killing Me Softly was his song by the Fugees, and Cornflake Girl by Tori Amos. So I can now, I am of the 90s, so I'm like, who? I was like, okay, this is a pretty cool playlist. I would have may have like peppered it with a little bit more late 90s or mid 90s stuff, because this is a lot of early 90s stuff, but that's me just getting pedantic. What do you think of the playlist? But also, what's your opinion on authors providing playlists and soundtrack for their books?
Teenage Dirtbag.
By Wheatus? Was that Wheatus?
I don't know, but that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Let's see. Teenage Dirtbag. I feel, yeah, by Wheatus. Wheatus, yes. I think that would be perfect.
Yeah.
You know, this is a, I don't know, is it a trope? Oh, 1999, that's pop, that's, man, it works. I don't know if you would consider this a trope or not, but it does seem to be something that, for me, happens very frequently with romance novels. Because they'll give a track, but like they'll give a playlist either of the whole novel, or maybe each the FMC and the MMC have their own playlist, or there are even some novels that every chapter has a different song.
Oish.
And so am I listening to these songs? No. But you know, sometimes it's like, oh, okay, what do I think about it? Listen, I love music, but I feel like when I'm reading, I'm not necessarily in the music mode. Like my media aren't mixing in that sort of way, so yeah. I think I just like read over it and move on. I don't sit there and think about, oh, what would this sound like as, you know, this person's moving through this. That's not my thing. So, but I think it's creative. I mean, I definitely don't, I think that's, it's fun, but for me, I just don't cross-pollinate in that way.
Well, what's interesting too is it's not in the book, it's in the book club materials that I downloaded from the publisher. So it's just in kind of like having some fun and talking about the songs that were in her head when she was creating the characters. And I can get on board with that as somebody who has been writing something over the last year or so. I actually do have a playlist for it. Because it's like, this is what I was listening to, or this is what reminds me of the characters, but it's not a, there's a difference between that and a flat out soundtrack, right? I don't think Ing's list is a soundtrack in the sense that she weaved it in to the book or anything like that. And I'm a big fan of like movie soundtracks where there's a lot of pop and rock music.
Oh,
yes.
I do love me a movie soundtrack.
Yeah. So it's kind of with that, things like that. But I have seen where people put the romance novel soundtracks up and stuff like that. Yeah. There was a comic series about 25 years ago or 20 years ago called Blue Monday. It was like two or three different volumes, and China Clugston was the writer artist. And it was very like teenage girls having fun, romance, sort of typical things, YA stuff that was really well done. And she would have, as you went through it, little editor's boxes with, this is the song that's playing now at this moment. Now, I would never kind of plug in my headphones and like listen to it as I was reading it, but I thought that was clever at the time. And this is the mid-2000s. So, but yeah, no, I was funny enough because like I said, I've been writing I'm like the second draft of a novel, and I have a long playlist of songs that I'm like, oh, this reminds me of these characters, or this is what I would put in this moment, or I actually did reference the song in the book. So I'm guilty of creating a novel playlist myself. So take that as you will.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I wasn't poo-pooing. I was just like, oh, that doesn't, it doesn't work for me as much. I think with the movie soundtrack that works more, just because, you know, I love musical theater. So the idea of some sort of visual medium with music goes better for me than a reading medium. So.
Yeah. Last question. Is it required reading?
I think so. And the reason why is because I think it has a great discussion on what motherhood is, what a mother is, and also is able to be cross-generational and have discussions about race to a certain extent, race in a small town, where maybe race isn't supposed to be a topic that is brought up, as well as differences in socioeconomic status. So I feel like it would be a great book to bring into a modern literature class.
Yes, and I will add to that, because I believe it's required reading as well, I will add to that is that this is a contemporary work that does explore themes that are common in older works that we're already looking at in American literature classes. It does tie into the whole American dream themes that we often see, like in 11th grade lit, like I usually use Gatsby and stuff like that, but this is the suburban, Shaker Heights being kind of the suburban perfect suburb, right? And suburban fiction is always like, this looks great on the surface, but like there's something bad underneath it. Whether it be like, you know, Mad Men or Revolutionary Road, you know, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. Like there's a lot of novels and movies and TV that explore that idea that not everything is like it seems, or it's a lot more complicated. And I think this is a really good entry in that. And I think that the fact that it's from 2017 makes it just as it's going to be timeless, I think, because I think this book's about 6 years old and it still feels like it could take place now. Granted, it takes place in the 90s, but you could read it now. But yeah, the contemporariness and everything, I think you just add it to that reading list. And it's a great way to explore what you were just talking about, as well as that whole concept of what we want out of being the middle class and being people in this country and in the society. All right. So we have one small piece of feedback. It is about Catching Fire, which was episode 112. Any feedback we get from Flowers in the Attic will go next episode, because Flowers in the Attic episode dropped literally the day we're recording this. So Robert Ward, our Scholastic Book Buddy, left a comment. Actually, it is about Flowers in the Attic. Basically, he's saying, I am so excited for this next episode. I have only read the first two Dahlgänger novels, but the next two and the biography on Andrews has been in my queue for a long time. That said, the biography does not have a particularly good rating that I've been holding off on it. Also, yes, I do own all four of the Lifetime versions of the films on Prime. I may not have read the last two novels, but they are bonkers and makes Flowers look reasonable. And remember, I went through the Wikipedia summaries or whatever, the plot summaries of those novels, and they do sound completely crazy bonkers. So I'll be curious as to what people think about that episode when we come in for our next conversation, which Stella will be leading. So she needs to tell me what we have to read for next month. And what is that book, Stella?
Yes, we're going back to a play.
Oh,
I apologize in advance because you might have to do an interlibrary loan. On what is available in your library, that, or who knows, but it is John Proctor is the Villain by Kimberly Bellflower.
All right. So
I know that you love John Proctor. So now we need to disabuse you of that notion.
Do I?
Do you teach? Have you ever taught the Crucible?
A long time ago. Okay. I taught juniors for 2 years, from about 2006 to 2008, and then I switched schools, and the Crucible we did both years.
Gotcha. So,
okay. Yeah, dude, I've always loved that place. This will be really interesting. So come back for that. Leave your feedback where we usually have it. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Goodbye!
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.